But you were knew that you were you what you were doing, you were calling oral history.
Yeah, we were sort of going
So
for the story.
what was your background or training in oral history?
I think the word was just coming into the fore right around then because, and again, if we could only remember, but we both have these memories of quickly meeting and me deciding to go to graduate school in oral history and us going down to, we took a road trip to Santa Barbara because she was sort of interested in oral history too. So we went to check this program out. And I thought I'd go to graduate school there and we got to Santa Barbara. Did we even go into a classroom?
Something happened and it was just not,
Just wasn't
it wasn't
the
us.
place. It wasn't the place. And I came here separately, and I can't remember if it was before. No, it was. Couldn't have been before I met you because we were already doing the work. Someone had told me that North Carolina was this really amazing place for interviews and documentaries and oral history, and I think the Southern Oral History Program was just coming into existence too. And so I came here. I flew to North Carolina somehow and did a presentation before a class. I cannot remember if it's a. I think it was a Duke, with a guy named Bill who. I used to be able to remember his last name. Everyone here knows him. And then we went to the Ivy. I remember that after the class, and we all hung out. And I was deciding again whether I was going to. I think they didn't select me, is why I think I blocked that. They didn't select me for the class to come for this fellowship or whatever it was. But I was still kind of interested. And I think our early grants were using that word of we will do oral histories. It was just. It
It was
seemed to
in the
define
it
what
was
we
and it was
did.
in the wind then as this new upcoming thing of, ferreting out. It was that same moment in time as the grant money is getting out there. We're trying to get the people's stories and document the people more. And it was right when we were starting to do our work.
And we always called our work actually pretty quickly oral mysteries. We just started using that term for, especially when we met up and started calling ourselves the Kitchen Sisters, and we tried to do an oral history of the Kitchen Brothers, and it was so quickly we became like these detectives, and we would write in this kind of noir detective novel kind of way, and we would call it an oral the story of the Kitchen Brothers, an oral mystery. So we were kind of goofing on the term as well, and then we used the term oral mystery again for a couple of things in the Lost and Found Sound series because it seemed to combine detective work and historical research.
So you really hadn't done any reading in oral history. You hadn't read Studs
Well,
Terkel or.
no. Well, you were pretty interested in Studs Terkel, and we loved, Charles Girault, and we had these models in the culture that people who were doing those kinds of things. But I don't think that we ever. I mean, I never really imagined that we were doing that same kind of thing.
See, and I kind of came more from a beatniky folk music background. So it, to me, was New Lost City Ramblers and all that early music on folkways, and it all just seemed of a piece. Kind of people who chronicled America sang old traditional music. I sort of came out of the womb thinking I was Joan Baez and played banjo and auto harp when I was a little girl and guitar through my teens. And so it all, I think for me, it just segued radio, oral history, being a folk musician and a beatnik and a whatever since I was tiny and just kind of, I never was aware of any of the seams. It all just seemed to connect one after
So,
another.
who were your models then? You say Charles Carroll, you listen to Charles Carroll.
I mean,
Later,
later on.
later
Okay.
on.
When you were first starting out, you must have had
No, so
heard something or.
this is what I was trying to say about no NPR in our region. I had not, I mean, I'd listened to radio certainly as a kid in Oakland and, KDIA and all the big stations, but I didn't, and mostly for the music, didn't have the same obsession with the disc jockey as Davia did. I think story is the thing that everything hangs on. I mean, I think Davia's interest in story, storytelling, and I mean, my interest in story through museum work and exhibits and all those kinds of things, that's, I think, the hook more than, I mean, for me, much more than radio or the medium was the storytelling, be it film, museum exhibit, book, radio, audio.
So you all made it up as you went along.
Or thought we did. I mean, Bob Dylan probably influenced me as much as Studs Terkel did. And Zora, when I started reading Zora Neale Hurston, I think she influenced me and her life, how she approached it. You know, that I always felt it was anthropological as much as anything, and but anthropology in the way of that you were it, you were part of what you were doing and kind of living it. And for me, again, it was back to the DJs. I mean, I was grew up in LA and transistor radios and on the beach and these voices, and I always loved that disembodied sound. I wouldn't have probably done this in another medium. I wouldn't, even though I love to write and all that and have written, but there is something about this sound just in the atmosphere and the intangibility of it and the imagination of it. And I, not that I was hearing these kinds of things on radio in LA, I was hearing Janis Joplin and Cream and Jimi Hendrix but long stuff and stuff that just let you travel in your mind.
Well, FM, and, you know, that FM way of hearing versus the quick sound bite way of hearing. I think that made a pretty big impression at that time in my life of just this endless stream, you know, and things coming together in unusual juxtapositions and not necessarily having to follow in a...
And Dr. Demento. But before that, the AM sound, the... I probably wrote letters to Real Don Steele and Sam Riddle and, you know, the KFWB, the K station in L.A. at the time, and being on the beach in L.A. and hearing all, and just hearing them kind of rhyme on the air, you know, their little chants and musical kind of sounds to the voice as much as the music. And then concerts, that's the other thing, going to live concerts, that was the other kind of thing that I was obsessing on at the time, and started producing concerts all at the same time too.
So how then does the collaboration develop?
So I think the big, sort of a big turning point was when someone, a friend of ours, sent our tape to National Public Radio of the Road Ranger. He sent that produced piece that we had played on our radio show, and it was, I think, about 12 minutes, the first one, you know, with music and cut together. And one morning we were getting ready to leave my place to go on the road to do some recording, and the phone rings, and it's Alex Chadwick from National Public Radio, and he said, "Hi, this is Alex Chadwick," and I said, "Sure, you know, who, huh? And he said, "Well, we have your tape here, and we really love it, but the quality is so bad. What kind of machine are you using? What kind of microphone are you using? What kind of tape are you? We want to train you to do this better, you know." So that was really, I think, the real turning point in terms of we really began to think of our things as shorter pieces and sort of think of them that way, and we tried to get a little bit trained. And we went to Western Public Radio. Was that before or after that? And Airlie. Airlie was a huge thing, a big radio producers conference that was held. And it was a changing point, I think, for a lot of people. That's where we met Jay Allison. That's
Terry Gross.
We came together and everyone played their stuff and talked about what they were doing and brainstormed, and it was so exciting and seemed possible. And pretty quickly after that, we went to a public radio conference, and people began asking us to come and teach radio production. I mean, of course, by that point we had begun getting training and doing more and more things in the vein that we'd begun, sort of a little quirky, a little offbeat stories and portraits, you know, cut together in sort of unusual ways with music or whatever sound. And so we began, we went to Alaska and several
Before
radio.
Before we go that far ahead, just going backwards, because there's Kim Aubrey, who Nikki was mentioning. Mm-hmm. If there's an oral history, he has to be name by name, because he had such an effect on our lives and on the lives of so many people in public radio. He's now the technical director of Zoetrope. And he started, I want to say he started at BAI in New York, but I'm not even sure that's the first station. And he was one of those genius kids who just loved radio from forever and then went to WISO. And he's sort of the Johnny Appleseed of a lot of public radio in this country. And he was part of the NFCB, National Federation of Community Broadcasters, and Mark Hand, who is now with the Station Resource Group and does a lot of advising in the public radio system. He was the first kitchen sister before we knew such a thing. That's who I did the old people show with. And Kim brought Mark and I to a National Federation of Community Broadcasters conference in Telluride, which I hadn't remembered until you started talking. I was going, oh, yeah, right. How did we know about this stuff? So we had already been aware that there was this thing called the NFCB, which was all these people at these college stations and community stations developing that world and that sort of network. So we were kind of aware of that. And as Nikki said, we weren't affiliated in any way with public radio. That was the only loose affiliation that there was. But somehow through the, you know, tundra drums, we started hearing about things like Air Lee. And we had now had on the Road Ranger on the air. And then we submitted our second piece, the one that we talked about yesterday at the workshop, the world's champion one-handed pool player, The Legend of Ernest Morgan, and they rejected it at NPR. And they said it didn't have narration, which was going to be then the through line for why most of our work would get rejected at first or be really hard to get on air, because it was just that era of, like Nick says, Jay Allison and a lot of independence coming up and, you know, changing the sound of the era or defining it at that point, because All Things Considered was still pretty new. But our second piece got rejected, and they put into the Road Ranger, when I listened to the NPR version, I think it was Alex narrated the Road Ranger piece that went on the air and kind of set it up and came back in and out, which I don't think we were even that aware of at the time. We just kind of were so blown out that our work was on the air. And then we went to Air Lee, and we met a lot of the people who were from NPR, and now people knew us, and the same, and people said, oh, well, we'll go back and talk to All Things Considered and try and get that piece on the air. And I remember our friend Bob Wisdom, who we'd met at Air Lee, saying, oh yeah, I found the piece, it was in the trash can. And he took the piece out of the trash can and resubmitted it, and now because people knew us, which I always think is part of what the point of the conferences and stuff is, when people are at single stations, not part of the network, not in DC, you know, not at a big station and aren't known, it's harder for their work to make it onto the air. And we had that same exact moment. And once we were a known entity, once we had gone to a national convention, once people saw the name, the people behind a story, suddenly the same piece got onto the air.
I think also we had, I can remember having discussions and really arguing with, not arguing, but, you know, trying to figure out what is it about this piece that isn't quite right. And they, you know, whoever we were working with at the time, the editor, I don't even remember who the editor was, but was saying, well, you have to tell them it's in a smoky bar room, and where you are, you have to place it. And I said, but how did you know it was in a smoky bar room? You know, you've got ears, it's the bar, it's the jukebox, it's the glasses clinking, it's the pool player. But I think because it wasn't the normal way of telling a story or the conventional way of telling the story, that it was harder for people to imagine it fitting into a format. And I mean, I think that's always the issue with people trying to do things that aren't exactly like the things that are already on the air. But so
to Alaska, I just wanted to fill in those blanks.
We made our way to Alaska here.
Public Radio was before.
Oh yeah, Leo Lee. His name has to be included in any oral history of the Kitchen Sisters, because without Leo Lee, we would not have done what we did. He was at Western Public Radio, and he established this first training center, first national training center for community and public radio producers. And we were chosen to be in the very first training workshop. There were about 10 people from all over the country. And it was like being anointed, and it was being supported. And up until then, we were just two people doing it on our own, making it up. And suddenly it was real training, and it was sort of taking yourself more seriously because other people took us more seriously. And we met Randy Tom, who's another key person who has to be named by name in any saga of our work, because he was one of the trainers there. He was also from NFCB and from KPFA and that group of people at WISO who are so important to radio in that moment in time. And he did a training. He'd already started to make the switch from radio to film, and he brought us into a mix of One from the Heart. And we saw, I've always wondered what you thought during that mix, because it's what made me decide to move from Santa Cruz, because I wanted to be a film sound designer from the minute I saw that. Did you?
Oh, I know. It was really an amazing moment. I mean, it didn't make me want to move. But
what is this? What are you all referring to?
It was a film, One from the Heart, and
Francis Coppola's film,
and we watched the mix of the sound and music and being set with the film, and I think it was a real turning point for Dave.
So you went to the very first Western Public Radio workshop then?
And they brought, as part of the workshop, we were taken in because one of the instructors was a film mixer, so he brought us into a film mix. So we weren't, in the course of these, it was a week-long, I think, radio workshop, something like that. One of the afternoons was sitting in on a film mix, and suddenly, me who loves radio so much, I mean, I always loved movies too, but I didn't imagine myself ever working in films. It wasn't part of my vision. But suddenly there was these pictures and this movie unfolding and someone sitting at a huge mixing board, beautiful, all this. I remember them. What I even remember more, and it's the through line of my life, was there was a big cappuccino machine, really old from Italy. And I remember walking in to the room and just thinking, I want to work here. I want to work in this building with this cappuccino machine and with the sound around me, because it was Tom Waits music with Crystal Gayle, with all the sound being put into the thing. And I was like, our work, but on with visuals. And it was just like, and I want this. This completes it. So it just had that. And then ultimately I worked with Francis Coppola with that cappuccino machine. But Randy was so great because he really took our work seriously and really responded to us. And he offered to mix things for us. And so now it's kind of, I guess that at that point, and we've been doing it.
We've been doing all of our own mixing up until Route 66. Mm-hmm. Or except for Warren Separation.
Yeah, no, I think we'd stopped mixing way earlier than
no,
that.
No, I think we still...
Because Lullabies and that guy Rich who engineered the couple other pieces, remember?
Well, the stuff we did at NPR, they mixed. I wasn't this bad. Yeah, when we did our earliest pieces at KUSP, we had, two reel-to-reel tape recorders, a cassette machine, and a turntable. And we didn't really understand the idea of pickups, being able to start and stop in the middle of a mix. So we would, on your mark, get set, go, and the two of us would be running all the machines and all the levels up and down, and we'd memorize the words and that you go up and down on. And this was a real feat in terms of our Tupperware piece. I don't know if you've ever heard Tupperware, but it's the ultimate, I mean, candidate for a heavy duty mix job. I mean, with lots of pots going up and down, and that was a real breakthrough. I think that was a very amazing, I can still see us
well, mainly
working.
It's a piece that's a result of mistakes, which is what I think people, you know, probably so many people's works reflects mistakes. And because we just, at certain points in that mix, just all the pots are up by mistake. And out of those mistakes, suddenly we loved the sound of the mistakes so much, the cacophony, all these women's voices, one cascading into the next, and it just came because we lost control of it, and then we just said, no, that's the sound. But
and
it was years.
The clutter of Tupperware. I mean, it was perfect for the subject matter, and I think trying to find a style that fit what we were talking about, and just that was like a light bulb going off in a lot of ways.
But it was different. We did mix probably the first half dozen pieces or so that we did ourselves, and then NPR would start bringing us back and forth, sometimes to Washington. We'd go in for 4 or 5 days or 2 weeks or something, and for specific pieces, and they'd assign us an engineer, and they'd work with us. And so suddenly, it's been a real, and we haven't engineered our own stuff ever since, and it's a real trade-off, because neither of us are particularly inclined toward engineering and really, you know, detail-oriented in that, you know, perfect EQ kind of way, and all that technical, or all that interested. And at the same time, that effort to communicate your ideas, and somehow we try, it's, you know, we have a communication between us where it's two people's ideas, and we know how to hash it out together, to add that third element, and finding that right person who you can get your ideas across to, because those are tricky things. It sounds better, but does it sound better? a kind of question. So that.
And also, I think a lot of it was that we were willing to, because it was just the two of us and we were both going for this thing that we could hear and communicate with one another, we were willing to work it to death until it got
to...
And there was no one to pay.
No, hourly, right?
Right, and there was no one to say, no, you can't, you know, you're done now. And I think that was a real luxury, and it defined a lot of our sort of perfectionist attitudes when something's just not quite right. You know, I mean, we want to make it right, and it causes problems when you're paying for a studio and paying for an engineer and poor engineers.
We're grinding them into hamburgers.
Exactly.
And they're going, stop, shut up. I think we were also really lucky. No one or barely anyone else at our community station was doing production. So we had almost 24-hour access to our studio there. And we just lived there and tried stuff. But now people have that more with Pro Tools or one of those home editing systems, which is the kind of other side of the breakthrough for that.
So your Tupperware piece was when?
1979.
Yeah, probably right around 80, 81, because I moved in 83 to San Francisco, and it was before that, so it's somewhere between 80 and 83.
And it was working on the Tupperware piece that you heard something new.
I don't know. I think Ernie Morgan, the one-handed, well, I think the Road Ranger, all of them were... those first couple of three or four pieces, I mean, maybe it was just because it was us doing our first stuff and we didn't have a lot of models, you know, like you were talking about who influenced you in terms of production. We hadn't listened to what was happening on public radio or how they did it. And so we were just trying to make it up and how we imagined it. And I think our pieces have always been kind of like little audio movies. And I think maybe it comes from interest in film and interest in visuals and just conjuring those images through sound. And I think that's the layeredness of it, and that's the multiple voices of it. And, you know, you can't put a picture up, so what are you going to do? How are you going to take someone there? You know, what are your signals to that person? How do you, at the beginning of a piece, establish a vocabulary that then your listener can understand? Oh, I'm going to hear these kinds of things in this piece, and it's going to, it's going to be like this, and establish a brand new vocabulary at the top. Maybe it'd be nice if you could do it all the time, but, you know, people are used to hearing things in certain ways, so it's tricky.